Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Welcome to the Whitetail Podcast, brought to you by Key West Ford. Visit keywestford.com, BC's largest selection of trucks. Joined by Ed Willis today, we're going to talk a little bit about the Canucks trade for Tyler Toffoli, the upcoming trade deadline, injuries, Brock Besser, maybe a bit on their blue line, maybe a little bit of anniversary, depending on what time or how much time we go through. And we might even get into some sneaker talk, which we had some illuminating stuff before the, maybe not, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how much time we have left, Ed. Let's start right from the top. Once again, shockingly, Canuck fans divided over a trade for that Jim Benning's made. You know, they bring in a guy who they hope can play in their top six, has some playoff experience, doesn't have a lot of time left on his contract. If they need to bring him back, he's probably going to be more costly than their cap can afford, and give up a prospect to do it. Like it?
Well, it's not that easy. We need context here. And if you believe they had to do whatever they could to make the playoffs this year, then you like the deal. In fact, you love the deal. Because they went out and got one of the real prizes available at the deadline, fits their needs perfectly, takes all the excuses away from injuries, all those things. And I think it was pretty clear, it's been pretty clear all along, and if people weren't paying attention at the subtext in this summer, when they make the JT Miller trade, when they sign Myers, when they sign Jordy Benn, when they sign, you know, who knows, all these other, it was all for a win now, compete now, make the playoffs now. So that's it. Now, if we want to have a larger conversation about is that the way for this team to go, I'm all for that. I don't think it's ever a good idea to start flipping first rounders, second rounders, third rounders around, like you're dealing with playing cards. But that's the path they've chosen, and we'll see how it plays out here in the last, 6 weeks of the season, I guess.
It's always the dilemma for an NHL general manager, is it not, when you're drafting players so young, and it may take 4, 5, 6 years for them to truly develop, especially when you're talking about third rounders. Will you get to see that? And this is where you get the cyclical nature of, okay, we've restocked, got a ton of prospects, uh-oh, we need to get where we're getting. Go all in, and then you're going to have this dearth of this dead zone where you're not going to have picks to replenish. So I have some sympathy for Jim Benning, and that everyone knows it's now or never. But, you know, if you talk about knee-jerk moves or moves to your right, eliminate injury problems, can this team actually do some damage? Can they win around? Can they win 2, 3?
With the way they're currently constructed, I have a hard time believing they can. And when you look at their record against playoff teams, it is 2 games under .500. They've made their money, you know, beating up on non-playoff teams so far. That's how they built their season. Having said all that, in the universe Jim Benning has created, he looks at his prospect pool. He looks at some of the players he's got coming. That to me was, again, there's a couple of different layers to this story. That was one of the more interesting ones to me, is the so-called Magnificent Seven. They've identified as players he thinks will be playing with the Canucks in 2, 3 years. I think that might be a reach, but very clearly he's expecting Podkolzin to step in another, I think it's 2 years, his deal's expired.
Another year after this one, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And Höglander, and I think this trade demonstrates they had those two players rated more highly than Tyler Madden. And I love Tyler Madden. I watched him over the life of the World Junior last year, and he is a dynamic player. He would have been a fan favorite. I mean, how could you not love him? He's 5'11", weighs 150 pounds, but he plays like he's 200. He could be. It's conceivable he could be Johnny Gaudreau. He's skillful, like dynamic, fearless, all those things. But he's 150 pounds. So weighing all those factors in and looking at what they've got coming, Benning decided, yeah, we can afford to cut this guy loose.
Well, that's the thing. You only have room for so many prospects. What does trouble me a little bit, though, is everyone has been talking, really, like good hockey minds, much better than mine, have been talking for the last month or two how the Canucks' blue line just doesn't look like it's good enough for a deep playoff run, and that's one of the reasons why Jacob Markstrom has had to work so hard to get them some of the wins that they've had. And yet here they go, they add a forward, and there's more talk of Wayne Simmonds coming, and they obviously want grit. If they're going to get to the playoffs and do something in the playoffs, they want to be heavier. But, you know, I know there are prospects out there on the blue line, but should this not be an area that if Jim Benning is really concerned about the makeup of this team, should he not be looking at the blue line instead of chasing a Wayne Simmonds?
Yeah, no. I mean, the guys that are out there for me are insignificant upgrades over. I wouldn't mind seeing them make a play for Brendan Dillon. Is a Surrey kid, and he ticks a lot of boxes for them. I think he's mean. He's got playoff experience, size, plays a heavy game, all those things. But when you look at what they've got, and now that the big O Oscar Fantenberg is back, and they've still got Brogan Rafferty available for a call up if they need him, and then the guys in Utica, I'm just not sure if they represent that much of an upgrade. Yeah, especially for the cost it was going to be. The fact of the matter is they've been looking for a winger to play with Bo Horvat for the better part of two full seasons now. And it just hasn't worked with the combination of Louis Erickson. I know Virtanen hasn't played a ton with him, but he was, he had a long audition in a top six role. And it just didn't look like he could produce consistently enough to warrant that kind of profile in the lineup. So that then you're left with who can we get? And Toffoli, really, like I said, I mean, if you list, he would fit comfortably in the top five players who are available at this trade deadline.
Obviously, Madden, as you talked about, a prospect that the Kings coveted, because you would think the closer you get to the deadline, the more you could drive up interest, because Toffoli was one of those names that everyone was talking about. So much like the Miller trade at the draft, a lot of people thought they paid too much at first, but you got to give Benning credit for saying, this is what I want. Here you go. I want him. Here's my offer.
Now the obvious difference there is Miller came with an extremely attractive contract for what we thought was a second line player, who has now turned into a first line player and makes it even more attractive. That kind of raises the question for me, for this trade to be successful, do they have to sign Toffoli? And do they have the room to sign Toffoli? And that's going to play out here, the duration of the season. But it makes for an awfully interesting offseason for Benning in the hockey department to try and squeeze all the players that need to be signed under the cap, given some of the contracts they have.
How much Toffoli is tied to news about Brock Besser, which seemed to just fluctuate all over the place yesterday. Only Jim Benning knows that, whether he had this sense that Besser was done for at least the regular season. How concerned are you about his play? I know we've talked to him on this. We've talked about him on this podcast that, that back injury seems to have had more of a lasting impact than anything else, but he seems to be getting further away from that player we saw as a rookie than closer.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's become part of the story, and the injuries play a significant part of that, as does the production. He just seems so dynamic in his rookie season up until the point where he got hurt. I mean, he was on pace for a 35-goal season with a terrible team. And I just haven't seen that kind of pop to his game since, that dynamism. He's still got some skill. He's still going to get you, I think, 25 goals, especially with the role he plays with this team. I'd like to see him bounce back, because he changes a lot of things if he is a legitimate, first-line winger. But I think given everything that's happened here over the last couple of years, you can start to reasonably ask, is he that guy? right now the contract isn't terrible, but it scales upwards. And in the last year, I think they're going to be paying $7 million a year for Brock Besser. And under the presumption, he was going to be like a 30, 35 goal scorer. Remains to be seen if he's that guy still.
I think you just need to see him get healthy and really be. There's definitely, he's not, you know, the shot. And even the way he's skating, not as you said, dynamic as he was when he was a rookie. But, you know, who knows how these things play in your mind as well. Or, you know, you always see this with coaches. Okay, fine offensively, but you need to be better in your own end. And then you never know how that weighs on a player. Still a ton of potential there, of course. But let's look at the last couple months of the season here. You know, obviously we'll have to see who's healthy and if there are any other deals to come from the Canucks, but they're doing this, you know, surge drop. You start to look at the numbers and the last 6-7 games have not been great. Certainly we have seen some great goaltending performances in there, but the other teams in the Pacific seem to be in the same similar sort of boat. Are the Canucks still a team to beat as they sit in first in the Pacific?
I wouldn't go that far, but there is so little difference between those four teams. I still think Las Vegas has the best lineup of all those teams, but their goaltending with Marc-Andre Fleury has been questionable this year. The Canucks are right there. Edmonton, it really is an interesting... interesting to say the least, but you know, looking at their schedule, what lies ahead, and looking at the way they built this season, they have built this season on their performance against non-playoff teams. I can't remember. I remember writing it, but it seemed to me there was something along the lines of 22-10, and I think 2 against non-playoff teams. They're 2 games under 500 against teams over the playoff bar. Now they've got, of their last 23, they've got 11 games left against non-playoff teams. And, you know, and if they take care of business in those games, they should be okay. Nashville doesn't seem to be capable of stringing together like a string of 5 or 6 wins, and that's probably what it will take. I can certainly see the Canucks falling somewhere, you know, in one of the 2 wild card spots. I just don't see them falling off the face of the map like they have in other seasons.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, everyone seems to be stuttering a little bit. Nashville, Chicago, another team that looked like they'd put it together and then really struggled. I'm curious about the rest of this week. Obviously, we're recording this before they play Minnesota. And then I look to having gone through all the nostalgia, especially with the Sedins, which we may talk a little bit about later. I'm very intrigued with Boston coming in here on the weekend, not only because of the history and that is one of those landmark games still for Canuck fans with guys like Chara and Marchand still there. But, you know, I look at what happened to the Canucks last time when they were on a pretty good run, when they went into Boston and didn't look anywhere near a top team in the NHL. Do you think for the players this is a landmark game, or a little bit of, no, we have something to prove?
Well, you know, Saturday night, hockey night in Canada, all those things, you know, the crowd is going to be, you know, jacked up. Yeah, it isn't. I'm just sitting here funny, just thinking 9 years ago.
Yeah, it's
2011, and yet it's still Bergeron, it's still Marchand, it's still Chara. And for the Canucks, it's Chris Tanev and Alex Ebler, and that's it. But yeah, I think as long as, like, especially Chara and Marchand are there, that is going to be, you know, like the kindling that fires this rivalry. If they can't get up for that game, I expect a big performance from them. I really do. They just, it seems to be all set up for them.
You know, I know that this was part of the attraction for Francesco Aquilini when he brought in Jim Benning, because of the way the Bruins had run things. They haven't won a cup since 2011, but they've got there a couple of times. There's so many different ways to try and build a true contender in the NHL, but as much as Canuck fans may not like it, I think you have to admire the job Boston has done, quote unquote, rebuilding on the fly.
Oh yeah.
I mean, of course it helps when you have a guy like Chara as the anchor. But to be able to do that and acquire the right draft picks and spend them wisely and not so wisely in the famous case of them having 3 first rounders. But, to look at the Bruins and the Canucks now and their journeys from 2011, it's pretty remarkable to see the different paths they took.
Oh, no, it is. And that they're not the only team like that. San Jose finally seems to have hit a wall. But they were, you know, there was a group of teams in 2011 who were all kind of like, the Canucks were there. They were elite teams. The Canucks were there. Chicago was there. Boston was there. I would have put San Jose in that conversation. Nobody had a hot clue what was coming with the Kings. But, you know, they fought their way in there. But all those teams, for the most part, managed to sustain their shelf life far longer than the Canucks did. When you think of, like, the Canucks, by the time, like, well, you know, they fire Vigneault, and then Tortorella comes through, and then they descend into the black hole. And these other teams are still, you know, San Jose makes the Stanley Cup final. Chicago goes on to win another cup. Boston, as you say, they've been a going concern. They came very close a couple of times to winning a cup. So, yeah, and you're right. We've often thought about the template that teams use to build on success. And Boston, is just they've just been incredibly smart with their drafting. When you get David Pastrnak, 19th overall, you know, one spot behind Jared McCann, or when you get Charlie McAvoy, the defenseman that really Olli Juolevi was supposed to be, I mean, that's just superb drafting. And that's how they've managed to stay relevant and stay near the top of the league.
Yeah, and I look at a couple of other examples. You look at Nashville, who I thought were on the cusp when they got to the final. And, yeah, they ended up moving Subban after they sort of, you know, in the Shea Weber deal. So they have made some swings for the fences. But you mentioned San Jose as well. What a disaster. I mean, they go the other way, and they go great guns after Erik Karlsson, knowing they've got this aging lineup, and said, let's push us over the top. And they've done nothing but regress, and they're stuck now with these awful contracts, a very ancient roster, and seemingly they're going into the black hole for a while. And you think of what a Death Valley that California trip used to be.
No, that's right. And, you know, and actually it benefits the Canucks. They've got games left against San Jose. They've got games left against Los Angeles, and they really have to sweep those games against the bottom feeders in the division, because it seems like the other teams are taking turns beating up on them. And I fully expect LA to do more selling here, like Martinez is going to be on the block here. San Jose might make another couple of moves. So, I mean, they should be a fairly dispirited bunch by the time we get into the last month of the season.
Obviously, they're defending champions. Is St. Louis still a cream of the West and the team to beat?
Yeah, I think so. I think they just think they have fewer questions to answer than the other teams. Just from the goaltender on out, and they're battle-tested, and they can play it anyway. They can play it big. They can play it heavy. They've got a skill game, and I think Vladimir Tarasenko is going to be back in the lineup toward the end of the regular season. To me, the fact that they've stayed at the top of a fairly tough division without, you know, their one home run hitter, it is a really commendable prospect. And I know Craig Berube isn't getting a lot of run for Coach of the Year. There are other names there. You know, John Cooper's going to be there again. There are other guys. But, boy, he really has done an amazing job. There's just something in there, kind of in their DNA and, you know, the structure they play with and their system that enables them to continue to just rolling. They just keep on rolling.
Before we get to our sort of anniversary talk and look back at the Sedins week, and we've talked a little bit about the 2011 team, coaching, just as you mentioned, is often, I find, underrated in people's determination of how a team is doing in the NHL. And if we look at the team locally here, it's almost like I hear Newell Brown's name brought up more than Travis Green's, because you know, you can focus on special teams as an area where coaching maybe has more impact. But what do you think of the job that Green has done with this group?
It's kind of an incomplete grade right now, because so much of it depends on how, you know, they perform over these last 6 weeks of the season. If they make the playoffs, again, so much of this year revolves around them. If they make the playoffs, nobody can really complain. I don't think anybody's expecting them to do any damage once they get there, but they got a chip in the chair and a chip in a chair in the big game, at least. If they don't, you wonder. You wonder if more changes are coming, because everything they've done, starting with the trade deadline 2 years ago, has been towards making this team as competitive as possible, as fast as possible, and they think they have a playoff team here.
Yeah, I mean, certainly if their coaching can help tweak the power play and get it back to the heights it was hitting earlier in the year, it'll go a long way, because, you know, if you get that goaltending, you've definitely got some goal scorers there. If you make that power play as the big deterrent to being pushed around. We know there's not a lot of fighting in the playoffs, but it is the intensity does go up. It's going to be fascinating to see how this group does handle this last push. I mean, we are here. We are, you know, we're midway through February already, and I know you're the tagline for you all year has been meaningful games later in the year, and it looks like they got them.
Yeah, and you know, isn't it interesting? You know, we're probably about 15, 20 minutes into this podcast, and we haven't talked about Elias Pettersson or Quinn Hughes and how they're going to do, and really their first baptism by fire in the NHL. And you've seen it with Pettersson, especially over the last 2 weeks. Teams are just, you know, there's an extra shot there. There's a, you know, a push there. They're just being a little more physical with him, and that's not going to change anytime soon. He's got to figure out a way to play through it, and you can tell him. It's a little like watching the Sedins when they first came up, kind of taking in all the information, processing it. Okay, now what do I have to do to change? How can I continue to play my game in this environment? Hughes, not really concerned about. I just think he's such a smart kid, and I think his, you know, that hockey sense, that hockey IQ, and his physical skills will allow him to thrive. Whether or not it'll be enough. Like, they just depend on those two guys so much, right? And is it fair to lean that hard on a 20 and 21 year old? But that's kind of, you know, that's the path that they've carved out here.
Yeah, and that's where the high draft picks do get, you know, the contracts they get. But you're right. You know, I think any sort of controversy over a Canucks and MVP this year has been put to bed with the way Markstrom's played. But next on that list is probably Hughes. Would you not agree?
I would probably elevate JT Miller. Okay. Yeah, I think as much for the leadership and the intangibles has the production, and it just seems his game is really what this team wants to be. You know, it wants to be this kind of, you know, like gritty, stalwart, two-way, 200-foot game, hard on the puck, heavier kind of game, and he's given them all that. So I, just on that basis, yeah. But Quinn Hughes gets my vote for Canucks Rookie of the Year. How's that?
Well, actually, when I do look, you know, I think Hughes and Pettersson are, I mean, that's the top end. That's what you've got for the next decade or so. But you look at what Miller is doing. If you hope Brock Besser comes back anywhere near, you know, what he showed his rookie year, as we talked about earlier, and then you hope for whether it's a Pod Colson or someone else to come in. I know you've said this before, and I'm stealing a line from you. If Jake Virtanen just came close to what you thought he'd be when they drafted him, that's like the missing link for this team to really put them over the top.
No, I agree. And that's why again, that was one of the other subplots to Jim Benning's press conference yesterday. He goes out of his way to praise Zach MacEwen, and, you know, he's found a way onto the team. He said, you know, they considered calling up Reed Boucher to fill Besser's spot, and Jake was kind of, I mean, Jake had a long audition there on the first line, and he produced a bit, but boy, when you're in that spot, you've got to produce like a first liner or a top six guy, and my sense is they just don't think that he's going to be that guy, and probably will never be that guy. So that makes for some interesting decisions in this offseason.
As we look back a little bit, we move into sort of our vintage talk. It was great to see the Sedins honored last week. I have to admit, I mean, well, you know, I know there's two of them, but stretching the honoring out over a week seemed at first like it might be a bit excessive to me, especially since we were so close to all the eulogizing of them in their last season. But it had a real nice tone to it. The city just seems so full of love.
It could have gone another way. Like, it could have, I think, like, it could have been like a reach. It could have felt forced. And you're right. I think it was just like the reaction of fans. I think the way they brought like all their former teammates in, and then it's sort of a reflection on just how revered the Twins are, you know, in this market and this province. So yeah, I mean, it could have, you know, I was talking to somebody and they said, boy, wouldn't it be, you know, you'd like to see them do this just once on a Saturday night game against Montreal. You look, okay, they got Monday night against Nashville, they got Wednesday against Chicago, they got Sunday afternoon against, are they trying to bump the gate up? Maybe, but again, you know, the it was a real chance to celebrate the Twins, and a chance, I think, for the whole city and province to really kind of embrace them and thank them for everything they've done. And on the ice is just a small part of it. It's what they represent off the ice, and I think it's the larger story here.
That's always been more important to this Canucks organization than a lot of others who, you know, obviously when you've got success winning cups, that's the resume you'll look to honor players. But here, being that cornerstone player means so much more than just producing on the ice. Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit, because I know you've got a great relationship with Trevor Linden, and you've spoken to him a few times this year. Obviously, and he's been very direct in terms of what he will and what he won't discuss in terms of the way he exited the organization. But I will say this, every time they've done something with part of the anniversary and he hasn't been there, people keep dragging up, you know, why isn't Trevor there? Why isn't Trevor there? That says so much about the Sedins that can even bridge mm-hmm. some of those things that they, you know, people want to come back and honor him.
Yeah, and, you know, and as it turned out, it really didn't have much of a shelf life. Yeah. I don't remember a lot of people, you know, trying to, you know, like read body language and what's he really trying to say here and what's the agenda for the organization. All those things. He was just there because he has this deep and abiding respect for the Twins. And I think it might be an apples and oranges comparison, but, you know, you think of Ryan Kessler's relationship with Canucks fans. And then you think, okay, first of all, the Sedins reach out to him because they want him there. And Kessler is clearly easy to, you know, build fences and repair a relationship that was fractured in 2014. And I think that's another positive story to come from all of this. So, yeah, it was just, like I said, you know, and like you said, it just some really nice vibes around Rogers Arena here last week.
As we look at the decade of the 2000s, I mean, we've did a video talking about it. So, if, you know, if you're really interested in it, you can watch that. You'll find it on our website. But it does strike me when I look at the way that decade went about coulda, woulda, shouldas at a couple of places. But when you look about long rebuilds, the Canucks seem to do both deconstruction and construction on the shift in the 2000s.
It was a crazy decade. There was about five distinct mini eras within the decade, and you know, it starts, you know, with the tire fire Mike Keenan left behind, and then seemingly out of the blue, Todd Bertuzzi turns into really a star level player, and they have the West Coast Express, and then Burke does that deal for the Twins, you know, and they're not the players they would be, but they're still providing second, and he's got this defense with Jovanovski and Oland and Sammy Salo and other players, and then it dies almost as quickly as we get, like, really 3 years out of it, 02, 03, 04. Lockout comes, so does Steve Moore. That kind of puts an end to that. But then they come back with the Roberto Luongo trade, and then they're down again, and then they're up again when they, you know, they hire Gillis, and he puts together, builds that team around the parts that Nonis and Berg left, and he has them in the Stanley Cup final within a couple of years. I mean, you almost need Dramamine. When you're trying to follow the ups and downs and the fluctuations, and this decade, the downtime lasted longer than any of the other ones. But again, it seems to be part of that trend where, you know, they falter dramatically, but they always seem to be able to, you know, rebound a bit.
Which to you is the best team in Canucks history?
The 2011 team, there's no doubt in my mind. Yeah, there's not. There's kind of the visuals they left behind, but you look at just the numbers, you know, I'm going on memory here, but I remember writing this at the time, the categories that they led in goals against, goals for, I'm pretty sure in differential, and I think you had to go back. They were doing things that not even the Oilers teams in the 80s were doing. Top-ranked power play, I believe their penalty kill was top five in the league. They were just so good and so dominant. And it's just a pity they were kind of – they just took a couple of body shots, losing Malhotra. And then the big one for me will always be, you know, Kessler – tearing his labrum in game five against San Jose. No doubt in my mind they win the Stanley Cup with a healthy Kessler. And then Ham Hughes gets injured in the final, and then this happens, and then that happens, and then, you know, they're just a spent force by the time game seven rolls around, which is too bad. But when I just think of that team, they were a machine that year. And I saw Pat Quinn's best teams a lot, like from 91 to 94. That 93 team I thought was a better team than the 94 team. I thought that's the team that should have made the Stanley Cup final, but no, top to bottom, that 2011 team stands alone.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I maybe lean a little bit more towards the 03-04 team with the West Coast Express at its peak, and certainly we've talked about that year in the playoffs when they collapsed to Minnesota and what was on the table for them. You know, Colorado had been taken out already, Detroit had been taken out already, but goaltending.
Yep.
And it ultimately...
If I can correct you there, Nami, it was actually 03. It was the 02-03 team that lost to Minnesota. 04, they lost to Calgary. But that was too bad because, like Bertuzzi was... quite frankly, he'd had a substandard season before that. But Bertuzzi in 03 is one of the five best players in the game. Naslund is a top 10 player. They have all these pieces together, and Dan Clouche just couldn't deliver the goods in goal, which is too bad. That goaltending so important, especially in the playoffs.
Yeah, that's funny.
But yeah, the way things were set up there, and for them to be up 3-1 against that Minnesota team, and it wasn't that they lost the next two; they got shit kicked in both those games. It was and then they come back and they're up in Game Seven, and I can still remember they're up 2-0, and I can remember I'm blanking out on the Minnesota players, but he got this crazy high bounce from behind the net. Pascal Dupuis. I'm pretty sure it's Pascal Dupuis. Bats it out of midair, and you could tell that spooked Clouche.
Well, it hits Clouche in the back and rolls off his back and into the net.
Yeah, you could tell that just spooked him because and from then on, they're just kind of waiting. And, they're scoring goals on chances that weren't even scoring chances.
Yeah, and ultimately, that's the kind of, when you have that situation, the whole team feels it and they get on edge.
Yep.
I remember that feeling in the building, and it's like, here we go again, right? So
almost like what happened against Detroit the year before.
Yeah.
They win the first two games in Detroit. They come home and Nick Lidstrom.
There we go. That changed right then and there. All right, we'll leave it there for this week. Ed, thanks for your comments. Dharma Kwana, thanks for your production values here. I want to thank you guys for listening. Thanks to Key West Ford as well, to keywestford.com for Western Canada's largest selection of trucks. Thanks for listening, everyone. Subscribe to us through Apple Podcasts, and we will talk to you next week.